I'm Tony Collins, and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. Today, I'm talking to an old friend of the show, Professor Gavin Kitchen. We spoke over the summer in episode 169 about his new book, A Fateful Love, Essays on Football in the Northeast of England, 1880 to 1930. It's a book that deals with the early commercialisation of the game in the 1880s and the fundamental changes that it brought to the game. Over the past few weeks, the book's relevance to contemporary football has been brought back into focus by the acquisition, to use the banker's term, of Newcastle United for £300 million by a consortium led by the Saudi Arabian government's Sovereign Wealth Fund. Not surprisingly, and quite correctly, this has caused a storm of controversy and led to renewed allegations that football has sold out or betrayed its soul. So, although this is a history podcast, the Newcastle takeover shows that the present is always in constant dialogue with the past. So Gavin's come back on the podcast to discuss the takeover and what it tells about the history of football, its commercialisation over the past century and a half, what it means to be a fan of a club, and in fact, what is a club, and the uses to which history is put by the game and its supporters. So, welcome back to the show, Gavin. What was your reaction to the takeover when you heard the news?
Interestingly dual. On the one hand, I thought, well, you know, for Newcastle fans, that's wonderful. I mean, they got a lot of money. Newcastle will be able to, perhaps seriously compete in the Premier League. I'm sure they'll be delighted. On the one hand, that was... And then the other was just to think, this is a further example of the fact that... This is a game in which money increasingly accounts for everything, and the fans know that. Apparently, they accept it quite, the bulk of them anyway, relatively uncritically. And, where it comes from, in the end, they don't care. I think I said in one of my emails to you, Tony, is there any takeover bid that would be unacceptable to fans, Would you care if the mafia took up a club, if they said they were going to put in, half a billion? I mean, it's a sad state of affairs if you happen to think that, this is a game which has been... taken totally out of the hands of the people who support it, and yet they don't, at least as supporters of a particular club, they don't seem to care. I care, and in the book I'm right in the beginnings of what I see as this extremely ambiguous process, and it gets, in my view, has got worse as it's gone on, but I'm not sure that the average football fans care. And let me be absolutely clear, to deal with the local chauvinism, I'm absolutely sure that if it was Saudi Arabia taking over Sunderland, they'd be just as pleased. I mean, I don't think it's anything to do with Newcastle United, just to make that clear.
I mean, I think one of the things that in your book, you identify what is, in historical terms, an incredibly brief moment in the late 1880s when football becomes transformed from perhaps a local game that's played by local communities, and it's very, very rapidly commercialised. And in a sense, that sows the seeds for the later developments. I mean, do you think that what's going on today, I mean, not just the takeover of Newcastle, but obviously throughout the Premier League and across Europe as well, Is that a quantitative development from what happened in the 1880s, or is this something completely new? Are we just seeing the playing out of that original sin, of the 1880s, or are things on a new level now? Is this something different that we're dealing with?
Well, I mean, I think as I say in the book, I mean, from the very beginning, working class blokes who made it at the top level of professional football and had some reasonable luck with injuries and so forth, over their lives. From the very beginning, if they were careful and they saved money, they could end up relatively prosperous, compared to the circumstances from which they came, certainly compared to the bulk of people supporting the clubs. But it is true to say, I suppose, that up to the 1960s, i.e. up to the end of the abolition of the maximum wage, professional footballers, even the most elite footballers, I mean, the absolutely top guys, you know, Stanley Matthews, the Tom Finneys, whoever, they didn't end up, they ended up as prosperous middle-class people, I suppose. But, I mean, they didn't occupy a completely different economic realm to the bulk of fans. Now they do. I mean, now we're talking astronomic sums of money, which turn people into multimillionaires. And if they're really stupid with their money, billionaires, it would appear. So I think there has been a qualitative change. I mean, it's the conversion of quantity to quality. But what really strikes me, Tony, is that although that's true, the attitude of fans hasn't changed. I mean, you know, the fans don't say, you know, en masse, well, you know, this isn't the game that I remember, I grew up with, whatever. You know, all they say is, well, you know, great, he's bagging in 25, 30 goals a season for us. Good luck to him if he's earning, you know, $250,000 a week. They don't see anything that's changed. I don't think. I mean, so then you might ask why. I mean, why don't they? Perhaps because for them it's always been the same. As long as the team is successful, or as long as the guy is, you know, doing his role, then good luck to him, however he's remunerated, I suppose. And if you buy, which I think I do, you know, if you buy this totemic theory of football supporting, and probably goes across fans in many other sport as well, whereby really what's at stake is the psychological well-being of the community of fans, that the team is simply a means of doing that, then that, I suppose that makes sense. I mean, you know, they're winning, wow, it's great. Who cares how they do it? I mean, because we feel the same, whether they're earning three times what we earn or 300,000 times what we earn. I mean, I don't know.
In terms of fans rebelling against new owners, that's incredibly rare. I mean, other than the FC United development, you know, 20 years ago, whenever it was, which has kind of spun off and it's a completely different thing now. You know, you don't hear of masses of Chelsea fans tearing up their season tickets in disgust when Abramovich took over, you know, the serial looter of Russian state assets, because it's a way, you know, great, he's going to propel our club to the top. I mean, as you said at the beginning, I mean, would anybody balk at the mafia taking over a club? And probably not. And in fact, probably in South America and other places, the local equivalents of the mafia do own football clubs. But it says something about what the nature of the club is, because it's no longer a representative of the community. It's become something different. As you say, it's kind of presenting emotional, it's more than emotional well-being. It's now something to do with the levels of emotional investment that people have in their clubs and their desire to be part of that social grouping, which makes you also wonder that if how far does that loyalty go? I mean, I think the only thing that would interfere with that is if a club moves from its locality. Like, I mean, a small example would be when Wimbledon moved to Milton Keynes and almost no Wimbledon supporters followed it. But other than that, it's difficult to know what would cause people to part company with their clubs, because they have that tremendous emotional investment in it.
And I do wonder too whether, you know, again, I play with this idea in that final chapter. I mean, I do wonder too whether, as occupationally based, residentially based working class communities have essentially disappeared, whether that actually increases this sense of the need for a sense of belonging and the role of the club in actually giving that to people who in other areas of their lives just don't have it. Whether that is actually that need the tendency for the club to present itself as some kind of community, that has increased, and that to fulfill that need in a society in which, if you like, real community is less and less part of our lives. Now, of course, you're right. I mean, there's still that sense of locality, in the sense that, you know, if a club physically moves, then that is a kind of betrayal. But short of that, I think, and as we were saying before, I mean, this notion of it being our club, you know, you actually have no influence on who owns it, the decisions they make, the players that come, the players that go. Yet there is this very strong sense that whatever may be the formal structure of ownership, somehow it's still essentially ours. Now, the only kind of real basis that I can see to that is that, how can I put it, broadcast football matches, as we have seen, in empty stadia, you know, just do not have the dramatic appeal of a full stadium of yelling fans. So they have a role as what you might call dramatis personae, you know what I mean? They're the chorus, but that's it. I mean, you know, they have no more influence over what the principal characters do than the chorus did in the Greek drama.
I mean, in one sense, the fact that, you know, fans, you know, and yeah, we're both fans of different clubs, so it's probably the same goes for us. That being a fan now, in a sense, has become the ultimate capitalist consumer, because whatever the club does, you are going to buy its product. You're going to go to matches, you're going to buy all the merchandise. So in a sense, that although it's a protest, you know, against the commercialization of the game, in a sense, that type of behavior, the inability to do anything other than simply consume the product that the club puts out, is it's like the nightmare of the 21st century capitalist consumer. One of the things I thought that's quite interesting, though, as you say, it's kind of this idea that it's the sense of community that a club provides, whether that exists anymore or not, it is very important. And I think that's got a lot to do with it. I think that in a sense, the protests against the European Super League and the acceptance of, you know, billionaires, governments taking over clubs, although they appear to be counterposed, and it appears that there's a contradiction protesting against the European Super League, but also, you know, welcoming billionaires coming and taking over your club would seem to be contradictory. I don't think it is, because I think people are trying to assert themselves in a world where they have increasingly less control. It's that kind of insistence that I exist and I want my club to do well, because that gives me some kind of, not necessarily control, but a way of asserting that I have a role in the world. In the same way that the protests against the European Super League had the same effect. I mean, I'm sure people objected for a whole variety of reasons, many of which were not particularly logical. But it's that, it's using football to say, look, here I am, you have to take notice of me, whether it's because my club's winning or because I'm protesting against new plans.
Yeah, I mean, the anti-Super League stuff produced a rhetoric of, I mean, it was quite interesting, it was very passing, but then it was because, of course, the proposal was ultimately withdrawn for the moment, anyway, which was that, this is a game of ordinary people and it's being taken away from them, and you know, it's become a playground of the rich and we've got to do something about it. Where we clearly meant something more than just, you know, the fans of Liverpool or the fans of Manchester United or the fans of Man City or whatever. It meant we football fans or something. But that, if you like, cross-club rhetoric, sort of vaguely, I suppose, class rhetoric, although it was, in a certain sense, produced by I mean, it was also, I think, to some extent national, right? I mean, there was a certain sense that, you know, the game was being taken away from its British roots and it was going to be Europeanized and our clubs would become, you know, I mean, there's a cat, there was probably some feelings there that are also around Brexit and all that sort of stuff. So it's ambiguous, but in any case, it was passing. And if you were actually serious about saying that in some way or other, football has to be, as a game, in this case, we say British elite football, the Premier League, has in some sense to take serious cognizance of the views of its fans, then you'd have to organise that. You know, that's, and you have to run a serious long-run campaign, I think. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff you'd have to do. And I don't see any appetite for that. So that's what makes me feel that the Super League proposal will come back. It'll be redressed in some way or other to make it more palatable. I don't quite know how. And it'll get through. I mean, I just think it's a matter of time.
Yeah, I agree, because football, well, all sports, just like capitalism, its tendency is towards monopoly. I think one of the interesting things, and again, I think you touched on this in your book, is that the protests around the European Super League, if you could have rewound to 1887, you can find the same objections to the formation of the Football League. That it's all about commercialism, it's not about the fans, it's not about the game, it's just about making more money for elite clubs. And, you know, as is well known, the Football League was founded for commercial reasons and clubs were chosen for their commercial strength and their ability to grow their own markets, you know, to use the jargon. And I think it is interesting that some of the rhetoric that was used around the European Super League and also in opposition to, you know, takeovers of clubs is very similar to the kind of amateur middle-class criticisms of commercial sport in the 1880s.
I mean, one thing that does interest me, Tony, and is that quite clearly the opposition to the Saudi takeover of Newcastle United in the Premier League appears to have been most vociferous amongst the clubs that are not the really rich clubs. You know, they seem to have sort of said, you know, not so much, we don't want one of our football clubs run by people who chop up political opponents. But you know, this goes too far. This is the final nail in the coffin, because what it means is another club is added to this elite. If you're not in that elite of clubs, you've got no chance, basically. Now, that's right. I mean, in the long and great run of it, I mean, you know, you do get the exceptions that prove the rule, you know, Leicester City's victory, etc. But they are exceptions that prove the rule. Well, if you are seriously worried about that, then it seems to me you've got to start saying, well, you've got to have different ways of organising to get the money about. You know, that if Saudi Arabia are going to put this amount of money into Newcastle United, no, what they should do is put the money in the Premier League, give a certain proportion of it to Newcastle United and a certain proportion of it to other clubs. Or, you know, we've got a situation now, apparently, in Britain, and I think in many other places too, where, you know, the roots of the game are seriously, seriously corroding, because basically, you know, kids are not fit enough, you know, to play the game, to start playing. I mean, you know, there are real problems in the grassroots of the game. Let's put some money into that, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there are things that you could do that these, to at least make the competition or less unequal than it currently is. And maybe that will come from the clubs and, you know, outside this elite thing. And that's nothing to do with the fans. That's just, you know, other clubs saying, you know, this competition is too bent to be acceptable any longer. Well, maybe that will produce something. I don't know. Maybe it will.
I think in a lot of ways, you can see it as a consequence of a completely deregulated marketplace. And that although in, you know, we've got the benefit of hindsight, but you can see as things like the maximum wage were removed in the early 1960s, then a different contract system was introduced in the 70s and 80s, then although it wasn't apparent at the time because the money wasn't there at that stage, it, essentially what was going on was a deregulation of the market, and you now have basically a free-for-all when anybody with any money can take over a club without... And basically there are no, despite all the rhetoric about the fit and proper person test, there are no regulations and they can do whatever they want. And I think this is the dilemma that faces the smaller clubs, because if they do say, right, this is how we want things to be, we want it to be more equitable, we want a fairer share of the pot, then that's when the top clubs say, fine, you can have that, we're going to play in our European Super League. So it's very difficult to see a way out of this. And I think obviously football is far and away, obviously, the world's biggest sport, and no sport can compare with it. But it's also problems that are facing pretty much every other sport. I think, ironically, the only place where sport doesn't face that type of problem, or professional sport at least, is in America, where both the NFL and Major League Baseball run an incredibly highly regulated market that is almost, but not quite, probably the nearest thing in sport to an actual planned economy. Because they have a draft, they have a salary cap, there's very tight regulations on what you can spend on and how the money's distributed. So there's that slightly bizarre juxtaposition that America has that different system that's more equitable, if you can get into it. I mean, I think that, again, the British-European system does allow promotion and relegation. So I think one of the interesting things is this idea about what a club is and what it represents and how that's changing, that people are hanging on to a conception of a club that I suspect isn't shared around the world. And I think one of the things that does make, and I'd be interested in your reaction to this, one of the things that does make football now different is that it is increasingly part of the entertainment world rather than the sporting world. And that for many people around the world, the way they relate to it, I mean, you know, the millions of fans outside of Britain who are Man United supporters or Chelsea supporters, or outside of Spain who are Barca or Real Madrid supporters, for them, it doesn't mean the same thing. It's part of the entertainment industry, and you support those teams, or probably you support the players like Ronaldo in the same way that you're a fan of, I don't know what young people follow now, but like Jennifer Aniston or Brad Pitt or that type of thing. So I think that's a different thing. In the marketplaces where it's expanded to around the world, it's becoming part of the entertainment celebrity world rather than the sporting world that we traditionally knew.
I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? Because, yeah, I mean, the great players do have this sort of star, they have star earnings and they have star billing, and there is absolutely that parallel. But the one thing that is different is that, how can I put it, their maintaining that status depends upon their playing a role in a collective activity. What makes Ronaldo the star that he is what he can do for the success of Manchester United or Juventus or whoever he happens to be playing for, and the same is true of Messi and so forth. They can't be yanked out of that. They can't be. They have no, you know. A film star can go from one film to the next, and people watch the film for him or her, actually. But it didn't quite work like that in soccer yet. I can't really see how it would. I mean, it is in that sense remains a team game. But I all I can really say about myself, Tony, is that there's something about this process which has, for me anyway, undermined the pleasure that I take in the game. And that's very paradoxical, because objectively, you know, when you watch absolutely top-level soccer now, you can be absolutely blown away by the skills levels, the fitness levels, the speed of the game, the accuracy of the passing, you know, players now routinely do what, you know, it would somebody, you know, would have been regarded as another star for doing in this, in even in the 1960s. I can see all that because I have, if you like, the comparative model. But it's somehow or other the pleasure that I can take in it has been diluted. And in fact, I actually now I watch less soccer. You know, I do watch less. I, if you ask me, you know, what sports I enjoy watching now, I'd probably tell you, you know, sort of track and field and I don't know, a bit of golf or something like that. I mean, and I think it's partly to do also with the hyperbole that is an integral part of the way that this thing is presented publicly. I mean, you know, I find myself in a situation where, well, if I'm watching a soccer match, I've turned off the commentary. Because what A, they're not telling me anything I can't see, A, and B, it's just this hyperbolic nonsense. And now, you know, and then I say to myself, oh, you just get no. And maybe that's true. I just don't know. But it's a loss in my life, I have to say.
I mean, obviously, as a rugby league supporter, yeah, I don't have the problem of billionaires coming to take over clubs. And in fact, whereas rugby league remains more truer to its roots than most sports, I mean that is also one of its big weaknesses. Because, and I think that shows a contradiction that's going on. Because the NRL is slightly different, but not too different. It's the if you can't reach a certain level of commercialisation, then that inevitably that's going to mean that sports atrophy. I mean, they don't die out, but they lose some of their vitality, or can lose some of their vitality. So it's a contradictory thing. I also do think, though, one of the big changes that has happened that has contributed to what you describe is the fact that football is so ubiquitous. I mean, if you have the right satellite channels, you could probably watch it 24 hours a day. And that must have some impact on the enjoyment of the game. That, you know, I mean, obviously you're slightly older than me, but certainly when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, apart from BBC's Grandstand on a Saturday occasionally, to watch football or rugby league, you had to go. And that, so it was a big event in itself and it was a social occasion. Whereas now, yeah, I would say, obviously in Australia, you turn on the TV, it's 6 o'clock in the morning and there's the Premier League. So I think that's how that slightly begins to undermine the nature of the game as it has traditionally been as well.
This process of commodification, it's profoundly contradictory. As we said before, it gave the possibility for poor men, and I suspect it will now, we can say, for, you know, women, girls from less well-off backgrounds and so on, to do something that they enjoy enormously, to make money out of it, improve their lives as a result of doing it. I don't know. It's the other side of it is that it does something to, I think, taken too far, it does something very peculiar to what it takes over, and something destructive. That's how I feel. But let me be clear. I don't think the majority of football fans feel that. I mean, I think a minority do.
Yeah, and I think it's in the minority that lies hope. Well, on that note, rather than continuing and getting to the getting to sound like two old blokes complaining about modern times, which is always a danger in any sports podcast, I think I'll draw it to a close. So, thanks, Gavin. A fantastic discussion, and I'm sure this is going to come up again because the way football is changing so rapidly, it means that it's the same old issues again and again, but with a different slant each time. Just to remind listeners, Gavin's book is called The Fateful Love, Essays on Football in the Northeast of England, 1880 to 1930, and it's published by Peter Lang. If you go to my website, you'll find a 30% discount code, which I think is still valid. And as I'm sure you know, my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of episodes about the history of rugby, football, and the other codes. So, until next month, thanks for listening.